Today is August 12th, 2015, and this is episode number 319 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, Vagabond. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
You really are a vagabond. You are our gypsy man about town.
Yeah, it's a word that it's gone out of common usage, and I don't know. I think I'm bringing it back.
I think you're bringing it back with style. Yeah, I like this.
Or something. I am traveling, so we're recording the show differently.
Right. We're not in the same studio.
For once, we're not the same studio. Because I'm in Austin, and I'm working this week. But next week is a vacation.
Yeah, which will be awesome. Which means next week, you guys will all get to be surprised when you see who I bring on the show.
Yeah, it's gonna be a real surprise when they see who you bring on the show.
Well, okay. What is that that thing where? You see sounds and taste colors and stuff.
Synesthesia.
Maybe we have listeners that have synesthesia.
Yeah, they still won't see who.
But if they see what they hear.
No, it would be a color. It's usually a color kind of thing. And it would usually be like they hear colors or they see certain words as colors. It's not that they don't – like no one has synesthesia where – they see Bob Levitis when they think guest.
Some people might. However, that's a completely different thing. And you jumped to a conclusion because you assumed that I meant they would see in a literal sense the person that I'm recording with.
I am mostly pedantic.
Mostly, yes.
Mostly pedantic. All right, now we have utterly derailed the show. This is like the worst derailment we've ever had.
Should I have the engineers play the outro and we'll just wrap it up?
They're shaking their heads now. They want us to do the whole thing.
Okay. See, this is part of the problem. You took the engineers with you on your trip.
Well, yeah. I needed them to help me operate the vehicle.
It's got a lot of. It's so weird. I assume you're taking
dials
the train.
And knobs and things.
Yeah. See, engineers, I thought you were taking the train. And hey, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, wow. Wow. All right. Well, I guess let's just do A to Z.
Oh, that's so clever the way you did that because you mean alphabet.
Right. ABC.XYZ.
There should be like a Jackson 5 song in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah, there probably is.
But the Google announced that it was restructuring into the company we know of as Google, quote unquote, today, is restructuring into a holding company called Alphabet.
Yes.
That owns a whole bunch of other companies or will once they actually get all this settled, including Google.
Right. So Google would become a wholly owned subsidiary of Alphabet.
Right. And a lot of things that are part of Google today will be split out as separate companies.
Like Nest.
Yes. Nest plus all the things that Nest actually runs these days, all the stuff that Tony Fadell runs for Google.
Yeah, right. Okay, good point. But I think for a lot of people, the fact that Nest will be outside of Google proper is something they'll be very interested in.
Well, maybe. It's not going to change anything. Nothing. Listen, all of these – all right, so we're going to have Life Sciences. There's going to be a company – I don't know if that's going to be the name of it, but you know, there's going to be a company that does Life Sciences. It's going to be a company that does the internet-connected hardware stuff. There's going to be Google itself. Well, we don't know if YouTube will be a separate company. I kind of doubt it. It seems like there's a lot of reasons why YouTube should be closely tied to the search engine to me.
Yeah, Yeah, that totally makes sense.
But I could certainly make the case for it being its own company. And that case, by the way, and this is actually part of the case that Larry Page made, is that with each of these wholly owned subsidiary companies, they're going to have their own CEO. Right? So rather than everybody answering to Larry Page, there's going to be lots of everybody's answering to lots of CEOs, and the CEOs would theoretically occasionally report to Larry Page.
Right. Right. Now, the thing that I think has some people hoping this is a good deal is that with companies splitting out from Google and operating independently, they think this means that whatever data that the new company has will be more secure because Google won't have their fingers directly on it.
Yeah, no.
Right.
Yeah. No, and a lot of people also think that the Alphabet will somehow be more transparent.
I think that one of the ideas you posited, which is that this will actually let Google and the other companies obfuscate what they're doing even more, is spot on.
Yeah. I think so Google itself will probably end up being effectively more transparent, because Larry said in his blog post announcing this, I do honestly love the way Google uses blog posts to announce stuff instead of press releases. But what Larry said is that Google's finances would be broken out.
Right.
So that will probably be more transparent to investors. But all the rest of the stuff, the way it was worded, it not only leaves room for all of the other companies to not be broken out separately, it, to me, makes room for all the for the other companies to not be broken out.
So, in essence, Alphabet can have projects that they farm out to all their sub-companies and do so in such a way that people just really don't know this stuff is happening.
Well, yes. I wouldn't say farm out. I would say broken out.
Okay, fair enough. I'll go with that. Broken out.
I mean, like, you know, we're not going to know what X Lab, it is singular. We're not going to know what X Lab is working on. Yeah. We're not going to know unless Google tells us.
Right. And that makes sense, because this is like a Skunk Works lab that they have.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we're not going to know. There's a lot of stuff we don't know. And here's one reason why. Not only did this announcement make room for essentially everything but Google itself to be less transparent, the chances that Larry Page and Sergey Brin and maybe Eric Schmidt, or not, we can get into that if you want to, the chances that they would deliberately set anything up in their company to make themselves more accountable or less transparent is slim to none, and it's really none. I mean, you know, we're talking about the guys who created a class of shares for Google to do a stock split that doesn't have voting rights, so that Larry Page and Eric Schmidt and Sergey Brin remain in total control of the company.
Now, even though I think that was kind of a crappy thing to do, it was also really brilliant, because they figured out how to do legally and easily essentially disenfranchise many stockholders, because those people lost their say in what the company does.
Well, okay, all right.
Okay,
as if, I know yeah. Why you're... look, can I give you a different way of saying the same thing?
I would love to hear your different way of saying the same thing.
That those three and their legal team found a way to allow even more people to participate in Google's wealth creation without hampering the company's ability to grow. How do you like that?
I like that too.
Yeah, your disenfranchisement is more accurate. And, you know, as long as everything goes really well at Google, or Alphabet. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, as long as the money keeps rolling in, shareholders would be happy, and they're not going to ask questions, for the most part.
Yeah, well, they'll ask questions. They just won't get answers, and they'll like it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, they can just bring in all this money through their shareholder program, and they don't have to answer any questions people have. And yes, I know there are laws that mean there are certain questions that have to be answered, but they can do pretty much what they want without having to provide details to shareholders. That's pretty clever.
Yeah, the whole thing is clever. I mean, those folks are clever.
Those boys, they're pretty clever. Now, you mentioned Eric Schmidt, but Larry didn't.
That's funny, because Larry didn't. So this blog post doesn't make one mention of Eric Schmidt. Eric Schmidt's going to be the executive chairman of Alphabet, the same as he is executive chairman of Google. Right? Mm-hmm. But he wasn't mentioned in the blog post. His role as executive chairman wasn't mentioned in blog post. And I'll just quote myself because this will be faster. It was all, quote, me and Serge, yo, we're like total BFFs, like for serious, y'all, unquote. Except for none of that's actually a quote. But he said, Sergey and I. True.
It is a quote. It's a quote of you.
Yeah.
Putting words into their mouths.
Exactly. But these are actual quotes. Sergey and I. Quote, my capable partner, Sergey and me, Sergey and me, right? Those are so six instances of Sergey and Larry, not one mention of Eric Schmidt. And I found that interesting. I don't know if it means that. So Eric Schmidt in the first place was brought in because Sergey and Larry, or Larry and Sergey, were were wise enough to know that they're not wise enough to make a company. So we're going back to the founding of Google. Mm-hmm. They knew that they needed adult supervision, and I believe that is the way they put it. And that changed. So Eric Schmidt was CEO of the company for the longest time, but the three of them did everything. All the decisions were the three of them. They all three had to agree on stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they kicked Eric up to executive chairman, and Larry took over. And what was that, 3 years ago?
Yeah, maybe. It hasn't been, in the grand scheme of things, that long ago.
Right. And the idea was that that they no longer needed that adult supervision, and and theoretically, I think the three of them were still making all the decisions. But I don't know. It's interesting. Was this just an accidental, forgetfulness? Was this an actual snub? Was this a reflection of some kind of reality that Eric has less and less pull with the two amigos?
That's a good question, or a series of questions.
Yeah.
I know there are people, because I read the Twitter, there are a lot of people out there that think that not mentioning Eric was a very calculated move, and that he has fallen out of favor. And so maybe his days are numbered. I think they're wrong.
No, his days aren't numbered.
No, they're not.
No, his days aren't numbered.
No, I think this was a letter about what the two boys were doing. And because it was about what they are doing, and from their perspective, or Larry's perspective, it didn't need to have mention of Eric Schmidt.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so to that, that's a very good point. And to that effect, there is another reason why I think this was done. And it's not like this was hidden or anything. And one of the lines in this blog post was that Sergey and I, or Sergey and me, or whatever, like to create things. And my interpretation of that is that Larry, in particular, maybe the both of them, whatever, have gotten to the point where just, you know, growing Google and stuff is just not fun. They've been there, done that. Mm-hmm. And
this is why you shouldn't have taken the engineers with you. They may be able to twiddle all those knobs all day long,
uh-huh,
but they don't know how to mute their phones.
Indeed. So why don't you talk? I'm going to mute my microphone.
All right. Well, while Brian mutes his microphone, I'll kind of laugh at him a little bit for not realizing that his engineers couldn't shut off their phones and he should have checked it for them. But hey, you know, what do I know? I didn't take the engineers out of our studio today. Anyhow, so like I was saying, I don't think that failing to mention Eric Schmidt is that big of a deal. I think that this is all just about the good old boys, Larry and Serge, doing their... I just said Serge, which is really funny, because now I'm thinking of Beverly Hills Cop, which is awesome. With the little lemon, you like it. It's good.
Okay.
I totally lost where I was going because I went down the Beverly Hills Cop rabbit hole.
As one does.
Yeah.
I think I'd be upset. If I were Eric, I'd be upset about this. I mean, he shepherded Google to the monster company that it became. It's mm-hmm. done very well under Larry as CEO since, but it's Eric Schmidt that played a prime role in getting it there, and it's Eric Schmidt that brought a lot of credibility to That's the company when it was young. And it was Eric Schmidt who taught both Larry Page and Sergey Brin a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you know, with that perspective, maybe he should have been mentioned. If nothing else, just as a show of respect.
Show of respect. Yeah. Have a little respect for your elders. But I think that they want to play, and this kind of structure allows them to relegate the companies, the aspects of Google that they don't care about anymore. So one of the things I can't remember. I know that you and I personally talked about this. I can't remember if it was on a show or if it was just one of our you know, many phone calls. In Walter Isaacson's The Innovators, he spends time with Larry on Larry and Sergey.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the fact that Larry Page was working on self-driving cars 20 years ago. 15 years ago. Some kind of high school science fair project or some kind of competition that he was doing or something. Mm-hmm. Right? It was something he was a young man and he was interested in autonomous driving. And I think it was some sort of subtask. Might have been self-parking or something. But he was autonomous vehicles are very important to Larry Page. He thinks that they're part of the future. And he's right.
Yes.
And they got to the point where he was working on something related to this. I read this like 3 or 4 months ago, and it's all kind of a haze now. He was working on this as some of his grad school stuff too. And at some point they made the decision. It was sort of like, you know, are we going to do self-driving cars or are we going to do search? Well, let's do search because it's easier.
And and they have come back to self-driving cars because they totally made it with the search thing.
Right. The self-driving cars thing didn't come out of nowhere. Right. The self-driving cars thing has always been something that interested that interested them. And you know, if it, it was the success of Search that allowed them to finance the development of self-driving cars.
So that's actually pretty cool.
Right. And it's something I'm sure he's still interested in. And he's probably just not that interested in Search anymore. He's probably not that interested in YouTube. And he's probably not that interested in maps, except for maybe as it relates to self-driving cars. And so this new structure at Alphabet lets them hand off anything and everything that they don't really care about so that they can go and play.
Now, that's a really nice gig if you can get it.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'm not saying they're going to be shirking their responsibilities, but each of these companies is going to have a singular person with the CEO responsibilities. Now, even if they're all the same people that were already in charge of those products and services and projects,
mm-hmm.
it's different when you're a separate company, even if it's wholly owned, and you're the CEO. It's just different. The whole team from the new CEO down, everybody's going to be thinking about things differently.
Yep. And competitors should now be even more worried because we have the original Google founders who have now freed themselves up so they can focus only on the things that they are incredibly passionate about.
Yeah.
And that being the case, there's a lot of products or markets or whatever you want to call it. There is a lot of stuff out there that they could get very passionate about and do things that would totally disrupt markets.
Yeah. So it's very, very, very true. And it's, you know, this really should make them more nimble. It just won't make them more transparent. I think that's really, that's where I am with it.
I think you're right. Yeah. So there you go. If you want a more transparent Google, well, you're going to have to find an alternate timeline. You didn't Probably. See me go in there, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I kind of feel like I feel like we should talk about that time Google did evil.
I was just thinking the same thing. Yeah. So I know what you're talking about, but I'm betting that we might have a few listeners that are not sure what you mean.
Yeah. It is possible. All right. So documents from the FTC's long running antitrust investigation
mm-hmm.
into Google recently got revealed. And one of the things that it shows is that that the FTC, I mean, I don't know. The FTC found that Google violated antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
And decided not to press charges,
which is very interesting.
It is interesting to say the very least. It is interesting, and I don't know. It's weird. There's definitely been a shift of sorts in antitrust regulation. I mean, you know, just everything from Amazon being left alone and Apple being targeted in the iBooks case to Google not being targeted for anti-competitive behavior. I don't know. It's weird. All right. But the thing that really stood out for me was
even more than the federal government saying, yeah, you can violate antitrust laws. We're okay with that.
Yeah. Even more than that. Because that, I mean, that was, we knew that back when the FTC announced that it wouldn't be pressing charges. And that was, either last year or early this year. But the thing that really stood out for me was internal documentation that revealed that Google decided to promote its own services in search results when its own algorithms deemed Google's information to be less relevant or useful. Either less relevant or less useful.
That really sucks.
Well, it does suck. I mean, on the one hand, just like Apple is free to decide who gets to be in the Apple Store, in the App Store, right? You know, Apple gets to decide that because Apple runs the App Store.
Yes.
Google should in theory be able to decide what gets displayed on its search engine.
That's true. However, Google has created a sense of trust and an expectation with its users. And by gaming the system and putting its own results above results that may have been more relevant or useful, well, that breaks that trust.
It breaks that trust. And not only that, Google has a dominant position. I don't know, in the U.S., Google probably doesn't have monopoly power. Bing has got like 20 or for some weird reason, Bing has 20 or 30% of the search market.
Probably because it's set as the default search engine in Windows.
Yeah, fair enough. And you know, Apple is using Bing to power some of its results too. Yahoo still, for some reason, has search. I mean, Google does search better than everybody else, in my opinion. Everybody else in the States, at the least. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have monopoly power, but it does have dominance. And so Google is free to make the decision to highlight its own products or services instead of the competition. It's free to do that, but I think that it's an evil choice to make.
I agree. So that means that Google has forgotten about their don't be evil motto?
Yeah. I think so. You know, don't be evil except unless it's profitable. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about making some sort of image that said that for the image for that story. Mm-hmm. And other people had already beat me to it. So I didn't want to glom onto something someone else had done. So, you know, I went with the photograph of don't be evil that is a sign that's actually in Google headquarters. Instead,
there's some serious irony happening right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think when you have built your reputation on the idea, this is what I'm kind of rewording what you said. When you built your reputation on the idea that you're presenting the best results and only the best results, to instead present your services when you yourself know those services are inferior, and do so in a way that's at the expense of competitors. And, you know, don't forget that the company was also like scraping reviews from some of those competing services and then just displaying them.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
That's crappy. That's a really crappy thing to do. You know, they're not only taking traffic away from those companies, they're profiting it from the work those companies have done.
Yeah, I guess crappy is an appropriate word in that case. Yeah, that's well. I think a stronger word is more appropriate, but we don't want to have to change our show rating.
Yeah, exactly. We do our best to be family friendly here.
I know, kind of surprising.
So I don't know, man. I think, you know, and this is above and beyond whether or not you consider Google's very business model to be evil. And you know, the fact that we're the product, the fact that, that they're gathering information on us and selling it to advertisers. I mean, that in and of itself is a crappy thing, but I don't know, this decision, it doesn't sit well with me. That's nowhere near a strong enough statement on my feelings on the issue.
No, based on our discussions away from the microphones, no, that is a very watered down version of the way you're feeling.
Yeah, I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've got a piece exploring the idea. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Yep, we will. And I can very safely say I'm disappointed with the way Google did this.
Mm-hmm. So now, one way you can express your feelings about Google is to buy Apple products and don't use Google services.
I like this transition.
And if you're going to be buying Apple products, especially if you're going to buy them from Apple, why not go to macobserver.com/Apple Store?
I think that's an awesome idea, because not only do you get the product that you want, that awesome new iPhone, iPad, MacBook Pro, or whatever, but we get to benefit from that a little bit too, because Apple's going to send us a referral fee.
Yeah.
And those referral fees help us pay our staff of top-notch writers and pay
podcasters.
Wait, we get paid?
It's all wrapped up in your salary.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Wait, we get paid? Anyhow, that money helps us make sure that all the things that we do to keep you informed and at times entertained, those things can happen.
Yeah, it can. They can. It's possible. MacObserver.com/App Store doesn't cost you anything. It's just if you go to the Apple Store through our affiliate link now, and we put affiliate links in when we link to products. If those products are at Amazon or if they're at the Apple Store, Mac Mall, you know, we'll use affiliate links. But you can also just go directly to those stores through our main affiliate link, and you'll find that at MacObserver.com/Apple Store.
Yeah, so do that, and
it's simple. It doesn't cost you anything. And it helps us pay the bills. And I mean, this isn't like icing on the cake. You know, this isn't like something that's going to make us rich. It helps us pay the bills. And if we can pay our current bills and then add more staff to write and record more great content, we will do so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that would be totally awesome to do that.
Yeah, you can vote with your wallet by supporting us.
That's right. So go buy more computers.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to buy them anyway.
Yeah. I think we just enabled people to spend money.
Well, let's enable them a little more. Now, I know almost nothing about what you've done here. But you've installed your first HomeKit gear, right?
I did. Yes, this happened over the weekend. And what I installed was Lutron's Cassetta. I think that's how I pronounce it. Cassetta Smart Bridge.
Okay.
And so it's just this little box that plugs in to my network, and then it communicates wirelessly with these little outlet adapter things that I plugged in to a couple outlets on my wall.
Okay.
And into each of those adapters, I have plugged in a lamp. So now I can, if you're familiar with Hue lights, I can do that same sort of thing where I can turn lights up and down, on and off, change the brightness. But since it's just my regular lamps, I can't change colors because my regular lamps are just what they are. But it's pretty cool because I can set presets for the brightness and all that stuff, and then control everything from my iPhone. And it's actually turned out to be pretty slick. Once I got everything set up, which I had a weird problem over the weekend that was network and server related, and once that was taken care of, then everything just went together, just real slick. And the whole setup process, including adding this smart bridge to HomeKit on my iPhone, was a very short process. Let's say less than 15 minutes from the time that I was setting stuff up to the time that I was telling my iPhone to turn on the lights in my bedroom and then set them at 25% brightness.
Nice. Now, wait, were you doing it through Siri or were you doing it through voice controls that are on the app?
Totally just Siri. That's where it got really cool, because there's a code that's an identifier code for the Lutron Smart Bridge, and that links the Smart Bridge into HomeKit. And once that was done, then Siri just has its commands that it recognizes, and then it knows, because you've named the different devices that are linked up to the Smart Bridge. So it knows what it can do. So I could say, "Hey Siri, turn on the bedroom lights." And then Siri came back. "Oh, I'm sorry. I just turned on someone's lights. Sorry about that." Because you know there's at least one listener out there that has the Yo Siri thing turned on. I hope this wasn't at like 2 in the morning and now their significant other just got woken up. And
yes, let's hope.
Yeah. Anyhow, so I was able to Yo Siri and turn on the lights. And while I was sitting there being marveled by the amazing technology that was just working, and I said, "Yo Siri, set my lights to 25%. And they dimmed down.
Nice.
And Siri responded and told me what she was doing. And it was really cool. So I can do that while I'm on my local network. And then I can remotely control the devices via the internet through the Lutron app. But being able to just set this stuff up very easily and just talk to my iPhone, that was really cool.
Yeah.
So I set up the other switch for the lights that go with my desk, so that if I'm doing say like a video thing where I need to have brighter light, then I can just tell Siri to turn on the lights by my desk, which is really cool. So I'm thinking this is really neat, and getting to play with this where I have devices on HomeKit where it feels like I'm on Star Trek, mm-hmm. and I'm telling the Enterprise computer to do something and it just happens. That mm-hmm. is so cool. But I'm also wondering, did this take so long to roll out? Is it going to matter? I mean,
how do you mean?
Like, have people moved on from the excitement of HomeKit, and they have their devices that don't have HomeKit support, and they've totally built out their smart home setup with all this other stuff, and so now they don't care?
No, there's still home automation is still in its infancy.
Yes, I totally agree, and especially in places like where I am, where I have a place that was built right around 1930, I'm surprised they even considered electricity in places like this. But I'm glad they did, because it's making what I'm doing a lot easier. But I've been able to pick up these devices that don't have to modify the structure. They don't require rewiring or anything. They just plug in and do their thing. So I'm taking a really old space, and I have this tricked out now to where it's doing more than many homes that are being built right now. And that's so cool. And now HomeKit is letting me talk to my place and make it do things.
And that's awesome. I don't know, can we dig into this question of whether or not it's too late?
Yeah, let's do that.
I mean, So yeah, there's lots of products. Lots of products on the market already for home automation. Mm-hmm. But and there's even a couple of independent platforms per se. But with all that, this stuff is just, I mean, far from it being too late, I think that we haven't even hit a point yet where anyone has anything to be excited about. This is still mostly the realm of geeks, nerds, enthusiasts, and the technically inclined. Even as simple as the stuff, some of the stuff is to set up. And I saw a lot of cool stuff at CES back in January.
Oh yeah.
Right? I mean, there's some really cool stuff. There's stuff to get people excited out there, but it's just far from mainstream yet. And I honestly, I think that it's going to end up being Apple that makes this a really mainstream thing. It's going to be Apple that lifts all of the other boats on its rising tide with HomeKit. And we're still probably months out at the least from HomeKit being everything that it can be. Maybe even a couple of years.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, as it stands right now, so we are in August, and HomeKit devices really started rolling out, was it June, I think?
Yeah, theoretically, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, see, that's part of it, theoretically. Now, I have something that is HomeKit savvy in my office now. So I know that at least one thing really is shipping. And I believe there's a couple of Echo Bee 3, the smart thermostat, the HomeKit compatible version of that, I believe is shipping.
Right.
So yeah, there are a couple things. Philips promised that Hue is going to get an update that makes it HomeKit compatible. And that has not happened. But at least
it'll come.
Yeah, it'll come.
It'll come. The point is, though, we have all the time in the world. We have we don't have all the time. There is all the time in the world for people to get excited about this stuff. Yeah, it would have been great if Apple had just, you know, hit the pavement running and HomeKit was just this awesome thing right out the door, and we can control everything through our Apple TVs and there's a hub and Siri. Done on the bed, done right to make it so. I mean, you know, worst Picard ever. But I mean, it would have been great if all those things had happened. They hadn't yet. They haven't yet. But they will. And when they do, folks will start getting excited. I really don't think there's anything on the market for people to get excited about yet. Let alone, like, you know, we hit some sort of like you know, peak, and you know, now it's downhill from now, and the opportunity's missed.
Yeah, okay. And as you've been talking, I realized that part of my concern stems from living in the echo chamber, which we do. And in the echo chamber, I think there's a lot of people that have already lost interest in HomeKit simply because Apple announced it and then it took so long for anything to show up.
We're
a minority.
I grow less enamored with the relevance of the echo chamber on a daily basis. We're part of the echo chamber. Our listeners are part of the echo chamber. We're on most things. We're on the front edge, not the mainstream.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. The mainstream. Most of those people don't even know HomeKit exists yet. They're, I mean, it just like if someone goes out and picks up this same Casetta starter kit that I have, mm-hmm. they'll be reading the packaging and they'll read this thing about HomeKit, and that may very well be their first experience, or even the first time they've even heard about HomeKit.
Yeah, I would say that the vast majority of people have never even heard of it. And I would actually say the vast majority of people are not even aware of home automation as a thing other than something they may have heard about it.
Yeah.
Home automation is not – I know there's home automation stuff in Lowe's and in Home Depot. I'm not saying that it's some sort of secret. It's just not on, it's not on people's radars. People, you know, most normal folks are not thinking to themselves, golly, I can't wait to automate my home. They're just not, not yet.
That's true. I'm very not normal because I've been looking at my place ever since I moved in and trying to figure out how can I automate this stuff.
Well, I think that the listeners of our podcast, listeners of the Geek Gab and Daily Observations and, you know, readers of our site, I think that our people are very tuned into this because, you know, we're tuned into it and you know, there's a, you know, sort of virtuous circle there. People who pay attention to the tech world are tuned into this.
Yeah.
Not just our readers and listeners. I mean, the blogosphere is tuned into this. The echo chamber is tuned to this. I just don't think that normal folks are tuned into it yet. I don't think they care. Not yet.
When I first raised my question, I was so thinking from the echo chamber standpoint. Mm-hmm. But you're right. This my concern is not warranted. We are the minority, the people that are going to get excited about this as HomeKit products roll out in larger quantities. Those people outnumber us by a long shot, and those are the people that can get excited. And when they realize that they can turn on their lights by talking to their iPhone, they're going to jump all over that.
Yeah,
they will.
Here's another thought. A significant percentage of people who have bought Philips Hue lights, mm-hmm. A surprising percentage will not have plugged them in. A significant percentage of those who have plugged them in haven't done anything with them other than turn them on and off. I have no evidence to back that up.
I was about to ask you where'd you?
I have no evidence to back that up. It's a gut feeling. I bet I'm right, though.
Yeah, maybe. Although the places that you can get Hue lights, initially, the only place you could get Hue lights was a place where tech-savvy people were going to go, which was the Apple Store. And that has since expanded out. So maybe what you're saying is more accurate now than when Philips Hue was introduced. But I'm betting a lot of the people that are buying Philips Hue lights are buying them because they have some idea how they want to use them. They want a light they can turn on remotely. They want a light where they can change the color, and they're looking for those sorts of things. So I bet you are wrong, but I also will concede that there are probably people that bought these lights thinking that they're really great, and they haven't actually done anything with them.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, and because even though Philips Hue is really easy to set up, I think there's going to be a little bit of an intimidation factor there for some people. Like, they get it and like, I'll deal with that later.
Yeah.
Again, I've got no evidence of this. I may be projecting unnecessary fears onto everybody else, but I don't know. I feel like I'm on solid ground here.
You may be. Although I will say setting up Philips Hue lights was stunningly simple. Setting up Lutron's Casetta Smart Bridge was stunningly simple. And I say that not as someone that totally gets how this kind of stuff works and being a neck deep in the tech world for as long as I have, but as someone that was really paying attention to what I was doing when I was setting these things up and watching everything that happened, from the perspective of what would make this easier or make this more difficult, you know, I was trying to think about it, like what would the average user be going through? And for the most part, I don't think that they're going to be going through anything that's that intimidating. They might be intimidated, then get it set up and be pleasantly surprised that it was easy.
Right. Maybe, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that once people take this plunge shift, I don't think... When I said intimidated, it wasn't because it should be intimidating. Philips has actually done a great job with the Hue lights.
They have.
They're really cool. What you can do with them is cool. A lot of the colored LED lights that are controllable from your smartphone, a lot of them are really cool. We've had a few deals on our deal site, deals.macobserver.com. I'll get the plug in. And we featured some of those in our daily deal listings of competing LED lights. A lot of them are really cool. I mean, just, you know, the ability to change the color of your lights to affect your mood. I mean, these are all great things. You know, this stuff is getting easier all the time. People shouldn't necessarily be intimidated. That doesn't mean that people aren't intimidated, though.
Right.
You know, and it's that project, you know, that project that you get and then you're going to deal with it later and then, you know, 6 months rolls by.
And when you finally do deal with it and it's like a 15-minute thing, then you feel so lame for not having done it 6 months ago.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that'll happen. And at some point, this stuff will be, I mean, you know, there was once upon a time when electricity in homes was weird and unusual.
Yes.
I mean, you know, at some point, home automation will be a fact of life. And it's going to be sooner rather than later. And I think that Apple is going to be at the heart of that. And I imagine mm-hmm. that Google/Nest will end up being another heart.
Yeah, I think you're right. Apple and Google are both companies that are very forward-thinking. And they're thinking about how we're going to incorporate technology to a deeper level in our personal lives. And part of that includes smart homes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, that's a place they want to be. And I think it's interesting how Apple is going into this as a company trying to make a standardized platform for all the devices, whereas Google's going into it by buying a hardware company.
Yeah, which is fine. But they bought a hardware company that's successful, and they bought Tony Fadell too.
Yes, that's very true. And to be fair, Apple did the same thing for the music market. They wanted to get into streaming music, so they went and bought Beats.
Yeah, and they wanted Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre.
Right.
And Trent Reznor.
And each company got what they wanted.
Yeah. Listen, normally when we record the show, I'm the one who's doing recording, and so I'm looking at the clock. I have no idea how long we've been going on.
We're at 52 minutes, 41 seconds.
Okay, can we do a brief little thing on the thing that we thing with the thing?
Of course we can.
Okay. I took a road trip. I drove from California to Texas.
Mm-hmm. That's why you're gone. The interns are gone. The engineers are gone. Uh-huh. And I'm sitting here telling you how long we've recorded.
Right. Exactly. And it was about 25 hours on the road. I took the slightly more scenic route, actually the infinitely more scenic route than the quicker route. My point, what is my point? My point is that,
I know where you're going with your point, and I'll give you a hint. Long versus short.
Okay. Long versus short. Apple Maps on Apple Watch sucks for long trips. And I'll tell you why it sucks for long trips. Every time I lifted my hand to look at the time, or to, you know, to get any kind of notification or something,
and this is with your Apple Watch, right?
This is with my Apple Watch. Okay. I'd be told that I have to turn right in 281 miles, or, you know, whatever it was, because I spent actually like 700 miles on the same highway. So, you know,
you probably could have if you had good alignment, just put your car in cruise control, and
it wasn't straight. Actually, there was a lot of curviness and
you shouldn't have done that.
Yes, it would have been a terrible idea. But knowing that I need to turn right in 281 miles is useless. And not only is it useless, it's sucking battery life. So I would get to the end of my day. There was actually one time on the road when I was pulling into a hotel one of those nights, and it told me that I was at 10% power. Normally during a normal day of activity, I usually have about 40% of my Apple Watch life left. Mm-hmm. So roughly the same number of hours wearing my watch, and it actually shut down one of those nights.
Wow.
I got to where I was going, and I had no power. But no, it was actually in the hotel. In the hotel, it ran out of power. So not only was the information less useful, it sucked battery too. And it was ridiculous. And I'd never noticed this before because the reason why I have Apple Maps on Apple Watch is because I like getting the wrist notifications when I'm driving around the city.
That's incredibly convenient. Yeah. Yeah. When I'm driving around town and I need to go to a location where I'm not exactly sure, I'll fire up Apple Maps and wait for the taps on my wrist so I know when I need to turn left or right. And it's awesome. I don't have to take my eyes off the road. I don't have to worry about, is the radio too loud? So I'm not going to hear Siri talking over it because my
Volvo... Don't have to look down at your phone.
Yeah, don't have to look down. Yeah, my Volvo is a lot older than your car. So when Siri talks to me in my car, she's just talking through the iPhone speaker. There's no Bluetooth hookup.
Right. Well, I actually, it's funny. I turned off Maps voice on this trip because there's nothing that annoys me more than listening to a song and then having Siri come over that song and then tell me in 300 yards, turn right on such and such street towards such and such. And then like 3 seconds later, turn right on such and such street headed towards such and such. Right. It just I don't interrupt my music.
Yeah, I understand that. And such street, I've never had good luck.
It's the really long ones. It's the, like the long highways that are like a highway that has a long name. And she's giving me the information that is very helpful. It's such and such a highway, and you want to go towards this town or that town because that's how the street signs are. It's all useful stuff, but it's really long, and if it's interrupting a good song, it just puts me on mega tilt. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is Apple Maps on Apple Watch is terrible in long trips. I've loved it on short trips around the city. Mm-hmm. But for long trips, it's useless. It's useless and annoying.
I'm glad I haven't had that experience yet, but I haven't had that experience because the longer trips that I have done, which would include when we did our TMO summer camp, I didn't use maps because I knew where I was going.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't have to experience the pain that you went through the past few days.
It wasn't pain. I mean, these are first world problems, to be sure. But from the standpoint of... From the standpoint of Apple Watch being everything that it can be, that includes not being the things that it shouldn't be.
Right. And now, first, I want to point out you made it difficult for me to take what you're saying and make it hyperbolic. But no, I said first and then I went, but no, that's not right. First. Second, it's still a problem for you.
Yeah. Yeah, my life isn't ending. This wasn't life threatening. It's not definitely not the end of the world. But it's an interesting conundrum because I hadn't ever noticed it before because this was my first really long trip to take with it. I don't know what listeners. What do you think? Have you taken a long trip with Apple Maps on an Apple Watch? And what did you think?
I'm curious what our listeners think because they may have very different opinions about this than you do.
And I don't even know what the solution is, by the way. I mean, because the thing is that when I was looking at my watch, I was wanting the time. Of course, I have the time on my dashboard. Certainly. I mean, there's plenty of ways
to get time. But you pay $350 to be able to look at the time on your wrist.
Well, there were a couple times when I was wanting to get the temperature, which I have on one of the complications on my watch face. Mm-hmm. And I was also kind of curious where my activity monitor was. But I wanted my watch face is what I wanted. Right. And I would lift my Apple Watch up and it's
directions.
Yeah. And I've got to push the digital crown to get back to the watch face. And So I don't know what the solution is. This isn't like some sort of obvious thing that you know Apple should have done. It's just I don't know. It's interesting. So what do you guys and girls think?
Yeah, let us
guys,
know.
Guys and gals.
All you hip people.
Men and women. Boys and girls. I've been in California for a long time.
You clearly have.
Clearly have. What do you think about this? We'd like to hear from you. ACM@MacObserver.com. You can email us. You can tweet us. What am I? I'm Team O'Brien. Is that what I am?
You're Team O'Brien.
Yeah, it's Brian with a Y.
And I'm Jay Gamet. That's J-G-A-M-E-T.
Jay Gamet with a J.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Gamet with an M. You don't have to. You've never had to make that distinction, but you know, it's a part of.
Well, I don't have to because you just did.
Yeah. Fair enough. Let us know what you think. We'd like to hear from you, and can't wait to see who you have on the show next week.
I know it's. I can't wait to see who's on the show too.
Yeah.
All right, that's probably about time to wrap up, isn't it?
It is.
All right. Time. Here we go. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And thanks for listening.
Now, whether or not they want to admit it, our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CacheFly, the basis by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed even when Brian's on the road.
We'll see you online. We'll hear you online at the Mac Observer. Good Lord. Clown show.
No, you shouldn't be embarrassed by your synesthesia.